Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, plans for a Facebook data center die and then are born again. Google Fiber rolls out its super-fast internet service in Salt Lake City. Also, toxic sludge is released during the renovation of a dam on the American Fork River. Trump holds a lead in Utah, and the Salt Lake Tribune's new editor takes the helm. Joining me in the studio this morning, Salt Lake Tribune Health, Education, and Environment editor Rachel Piper. Good morning.
Good morning.
Government reporter Robert Gerke, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Government reporter Matt Canham as well, thanks for being here.
Hello.
And reporter Tony Semerat is with us as well. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
Listeners, you can join the conversation with your comments and questions at sltrib.com or call us up at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. There's a good deal in the way of politics, environment, and government stories to get to today, but maybe to kick things off, a little news about the news. Tony Semerad, the Salt Lake Tribune's new editor, took over this past week. Jennifer Napier-Pierce is a familiar name to KCPW listeners, in fact, to public radio listeners in Utah in general. She came on board at the Tribune this week. What was the scene in the newsroom when that happened?
Okay, so Jennifer, our new publisher and owner, Paul Huntsman, and his dad, John Huntsman Sr., were in the newsroom for a staff-wide meeting on Monday. Kind of a cool scene, the three of them on one side of the room and all of us kind of facing them. So they kind of gave us a rundown as to what to expect with Jennifer. She's starting about a week and a half early. She was supposed to start September 1. And in the changeover of the editorship position, they were kind of caught short. So she's starting about a week early.
Okay, and she's replacing editor Terry Orme, who led the Tribune through some pretty difficult times, which means that I'm imagining Jennifer has some big shoes to fill. What has the response been among yourselves, among the reporters and editors at the Salt Lake Tribune, to this change?
Well, I'm feeling a sort of a generally positive reception in there. I think there's still some persistent sadness about Terry's departure. He was ostensibly offered an emeritus position. He could have stuck around and been part of the transition, we learned on Monday. And rather than kind of operate with Jennifer at the helm, he chose to leave. So it was a little abrupt, I think, for some staff members. And there, like I say, a little bit of a grief as kind of a beloved figure in the newsroom. But Jennifer's very energetic already. We're getting a lot of sort of form to what they where they want to take the paper. And that's exciting after a period of about, you know, 3 or 4 years of semi-stagnation under the old corporate ownership.
Right, a period of time where the Tribune was owned by a hedge fund, a distant hedge fund somewhere else. So Paul Huntsman, billionaire John Huntsman Sr. on hand as Jennifer takes up the mantle. What did they have to say about this new chapter, where the Tribune might go, and what to expect in the future?
Well, we should expect some pretty dramatic changes to our digital presence, to the Tribune's digital presence. There was a lot of talk about revamping the website, redoing the mobile application. And I think there's kind of a general reorientation towards, being more digital-centered, exploring more platforms that are being sought by especially younger news consumers. We had subsequent meetings in the week that, like I say, are sort of giving some shape to what they're thinking.
Is this, so a digital future, is there an attempt to reach, I'm guessing this is an attempt to reach new audiences and therefore new revenue sources, as all newspapers seem to be trying to do right
yeah.
now?
Yeah. Well, clearly the Huntsmans bought the paper because it was kind of financially troubled. It was losing some money, and this was an act meant to kind of preserve the paper's legacy in this market. The Huntsmans have made clear they kind of recognize the important role that the Tribune plays. And the message we got on Monday from Paul was, he is interested in returning the paper to profitability. It doesn't seem like it's a huge hurry. He's seems to be a very methodical, diligent person in sort of studying what he's bought, in his words, digesting the transaction. But they've already got some ideas, and He said he wants to return the paper to profitability eventually,
right.
And is not averse to some capital investments, but it's not an open check.
And at the same time, there have been some hints about building back some sections of the newspaper that have been cut or shrunk because of budget cuts over the years as well. Is that right?
Yeah, they've apparently already, since they finalized the purchase in kind of the May-June window, they've already forestalled some reductions in the print space that's available to the Tribune. There was to be a cut to those. Some of that's been forestalled, and Paul Huntsman was already talking about restoring some pages.
It's often, when you think about the news, it's often what we need to know more than necessarily what we want to know. And I guess the question that I'm kind of asking here is, what is the model? Do we have any sense of how that profitability might occur? Is there a new way of bringing in money? I'm asking this because there has been hints at a paywall for the Salt Lake Tribune.
There were mentions of a paywall. You know, there's no question that this upswell of optimism in the newsroom is kind of against a pretty major downdraft of what the industry as a whole faces. You know, advertising revenues continue to drop as audiences fragment and they move online. You know, the sense from my reporting is that Paul Huntsman is being very diligent about this, has talked to a wide variety of industry experts. And does he have the final answer? I don't think so. I don't think anybody does. The way he put it to us was a paywall may well be in the future. He's interested in improving the quality of what we're offering online, both the website and the mobile app, before we even begin to think about charging. But, you know, his analysis, and there's obviously others that feel this way, others that don't, is that we're probably looking at a paywall. And I think the time frame, correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, was between about 12 months and 3 years. Isn't that what he said?
Yeah, that's what he brought up. I mean, my take from listening to that meeting and subsequent conversations that we are in a period of experimentation and that our owner and new editor want to hear ideas about how to reach audiences, how to grow the business, how to make money, how to engage with our readers. This is, you know, I personally look at this as a very exciting period of time because we've been through a lot of rough years, and I think as a newsroom, we kind of hunkered down to our core business, did, you know, hard news and did it very well, but we didn't really stretch our legs a little bit and try some things. I think this is what we're going to see, but I also think it's going to be we're going to take a little more patience than we, you know, than I personally might want to have here. This is going to take months and even years to develop.
Well, and this is Matt Canham saying this, and you know, the I guess part of this is that you are reporters and editors, and it's not necessarily your responsibility to think about the profitability or how to make money for the paper. You are out there reporting the news,
right? But we do need to think about our audience and how do we deliver our news to our audience, even as reporters. And so I think that what we've seen from Jennifer is a desire to get ideas, how to change practices and keep the news strong. I mean, and that's something that I think we all want. We don't want it. This isn't essentially an exercise in dumbing down news or not providing strong coverage on the government or environment or anything else that we currently cover. It's doing things slightly differently and making it more accessible to an audience.
A quick reminder to our listeners that you can join this conversation with your calls at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Before we leave this topic and move to other things, I want to ask about Tony, maybe you can address this, the joint operating agreement between the Tribune and the LDS Church-owned Deseret News. Part of the Tribune's recent, I guess, issues, problems have had to do with some changes that were made to the profit-sharing split between the two newspapers. The Trib lost a big cut in those changes, which were reportedly paid for by the Deseret News. Any word on I know that there was an undoing of that to some extent, but any word on further movement on the joint operating agreement and the Tribune's share of that?
Right. So, yeah, my favorite topic, the JOA. the revenue split was reconfigured a little bit with the purchase. It had landed at 70-30, giving us about half the revenues we had before it was renegotiated in 2013. That's been restored to a kind of a 40-60 split, so we're still we still get the lesser share between us and our JOA partner, the Deseret News. There've been some renegotiations in terms of how digital ads are sold that's supposed to help our revenue stream to a certain extent. And Paul Huntsman in the meeting on Monday mentioned that he's interested in further renegotiations to maybe move that revenue split a little bit more to the Tribune's advantage. It's a little bit of a hidden factor here, but with each gain in the profit share, we're also taking on additional costs because you know we have to generate that money somehow. Right. And so it's an interesting sort of business balance for Huntsman to kind of figure out where the right strike point is right now. But he did mention an interest in renegotiating those points further.
Okay. I think it's odd that that is ad money that pays for the watchdog journalism that we rely on, but that's, I guess, the model that we're working with. New chapter for the Salt Lake Tribune. The Salt Lake Tribune's coverage of everything, including itself, can be found online at sltrib.com, maybe even on your front porch. Let's turn to some politics next. Matt Canham, a new poll says that most Utahns don't want Senator Orrin Hatch to run for an eighth six-year term. Who conducted this poll and what were its results?
So Public Policy Polling is a Democratic firm, does a lot of national polls, and they're known for doing some quirky things as well. And they decided to come into Utah, do a poll, and then just announce all the results. So I don't even know if they have a client for this one, essentially. They just do it as a marketing tool. And they asked a bunch of questions, some oddball ones, but one that caught our eye was, should Orrin Hatch run for re-election in 2018? 19% said yes, 71% said no, and that includes 65% of Republicans. Orrin Hatch, when he finishes this term at the end of 2017, will have been in the Senate for 42 years.
Wow.
And he was 42 when he was elected in 1979. So exactly half of his life will be spent in the United States Senate. And so he said in 2012 that he would not run again. Since then, he has not said that. He has hinted that he is considering it in public comments as well as private conversations, that he might give it another go because he is now the chairman of the Finance Committee, which oversees tax and healthcare policy, and he could still be chairman for two more years after this term ends. So he might try to stick around
for another term, another six-year term. Didn't he? I mean, this is it's almost obligatory, this question, when we're talking about terms, Senate terms, and Orrin Hatch. Didn't he, in his first campaign for Senate, when he was first running, wasn't he somebody who was advocating for term limits at the time?
So he didn't necessarily advocate for term limits, but he did say that the senator at the time, a Democrat, had been there too long. It was two terms.
His big slogan during that campaign was his applause line was, "What do you call an 18? What do you call somebody who served in the Senate for 18 years? You call them home." Huh. And so he beat up Frank Moss pretty good with that that line. Now, of course, it doesn't apply because
42 years.
He's 42
well,
years
and
later.
The interesting part is, you know, even Hatch's people believe if the numbers had changed and he had just fallen. His election fell the same year Bob Bennett's election was. He would have got defeated. Anyone who ran that year was toast.
Right.
That was the year of the rise of the Tea Party, and there was a lot of angst about establishment Republicans. He got lucky, and his was 2 years later. He spent $10 million on the primary election to change the type of people who went out to caucuses. He won that election. And I think that, you know, it shows that even when the odds might feel like they're stacked against him, he's a man of considerable resources and experience. And if he wants to run again, even though there's going to be a lot of people who would stand up against that, it will be formidable.
Resilience there. But there is, as this reporting points out in the polls, some dissatisfaction with people who have been in government for quite a long time, with government in general, in fact, and that could make Hatch vulnerable should he decide to run
again. Yeah, I mean, if he runs again, as I said, he'd be formidable. But that does not mean he would necessarily win. There are other Republicans lining up to look at this. And I had some names in there as such as Representative Chris Stewart, a congressman. There's State Senator Deidre Henderson's looking at it. Boyd Matheson, who was Mike Lee's chief of staff and now runs the Sutherland Institute. Names I didn't put on there but probably should have would be Attorney General Sean Reyes and Dan Lillenquist, a former state senator who ran against Hatch last time. Josh Romney as well. I mean, there's a lot of names. Even John Huntsman Jr. has been floated and has said that he would, you know, take a look at it. So there's a lot of pent-up demand for a Senate seat.
Waiting in the wings as well. Are we missing anybody from this list? Who else can we add to it? Tony Semerant says
Tony
he's throwing his name in the
run as well. He just broke some news right there on the radio.
Absolutely. Well, it's an interesting story. We're going to have to take actually our first break right now. When we return, a little bit more on the politics side, and then also the resurrected initiative to bring a Facebook data center to West Jordan. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and across the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
This week on Wait, Wait, it's something odd, something new, a bunch of things borrowed, but nothing blue, because, you know, this is NPR. We'll have some favorite interviews from the recent past, plus a brand new interview with Simpsons producer Bill Oakley, plus new fun and games with panelists Jesse Klein, Alonzo Bowden, and Luke Burbank. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Join us Saturday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members. And support for the Utah StoryCorps project is made possible in part by our members and Utah State University Uinta Basin, offering over 45 accredited degree options, including Human Services, Sciences, and Natural Resources. More information at uintabasin.usu.edu.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined in studio by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke, Rachel Piper, Matt Canham, and Tony Semerad. You can join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com or calling us at 801-355-TALK. Returning to politics for a moment more, Robert Gerke, a new poll shows that Donald Trump has kind of a comfortable lead, well, a somewhat comfortable lead here in Utah.
Right. Again, this was the public policy polling, the firm that Matt mentioned that did the Orrin Hatch poll. It showed him with a 15-point lead in the state over Hillary Clinton. There's a couple interesting things about this. To put it into context, I mean, this is a state that went for, I think it was 42 points that Mitt Romney won the state by, and I think George Bush won it by a similar margin. So a 15-point cushion is not necessarily a big cushion for a Republican running in Utah. But 15 points is some daylight, which he didn't have before. And I think that's one of the interesting points about this is that early on, you know, these polls were showing it neck and neck, right? The Tribune poll from June showed it tied, and now it's a 15-point lead. And it's kind of surprising just given the fact that he hasn't had a very good campaign operation. I mean, he's been fighting with the family of a dead soldier. He's been fighting with a baby. He's changing course on immigration. All of these things that haven't gone well for him, but it doesn't seem to matter. He seems to be opening up a gap. The second thing that I think was interesting about the poll is this was the first poll that had Evan McMullen in it. Evan McMullen is sort of the never Trump guy.
Right.
He's born in Provo, went to BYU. He's the conservative alternative for people who can't stomach Donald Trump. And he has a fair amount of support in Utah. I mean, he hasn't really done much of anything in the state, but according to this poll, it had 9%. So he's close to double digits. He took some of that, it looked like, from Gary Johnson and some of it from Donald Trump, it looks like. So you know, there's some daylight there for him to run.
How does Hillary Clinton fare in this poll? I mean, I thought, Trump himself said that he had a tremendous problem in the state of Utah. Is this more about Trump's, you know, not having a tremendous problem, or more about Hillary having a really serious problem?
Right. Well, you hit it on the head, I think, because, you know, Trump's not well-liked in Utah. I mean, most of the people in the state say that they don't, you know, for example, don't trust him with the nuclear codes and things like that. But, you know, as much as he's disliked, Hillary is disliked as much or more, you know. And so that's really the problem. So 81% of Utahns say they have an unfavorable opinion of Trump. But 84%. Oh, I'm sorry, that was of Mormons. But the point is that it's as much as Trump is disliked, Hillary is more disliked, and so that's the problem. And so right now he's at 39%, she's at 24%, and the third party candidates are down lower.
And drawing maybe from both or at least from him, the Clinton campaign meanwhile opened up a field office in Salt Lake City on Tuesday.
Yeah, they did. And this isn't too surprising. The Trump campaign's doing the same thing, but you know they're saying that, you know, they're not ignoring Utah, that they're going to put some resources here, that they're going to try to campaign and see if they can turn it. You know, it's obviously the electoral math. They don't need Utah to win the election.
No.
But they would like to at least have a good showing here, maybe make some inroads, help other Democratic candidates, particularly Doug Owens. And so, you know, they've opened their office. It's up in sort of the Holiday East Mill Creek area, and they're gonna have a presence here, as is the Trump campaign.
And is that this is just a formality, but is that a normal thing? Do Democratic presidential candidates generally open up a field office each campaign season in every state across the union? Or I mean, like in Utah?
Recent times, especially, that's sort of, they call it the 50 state strategy. They don't want to ignore any place, and so I'm fairly certain Obama had one. I know Mitt Romney had a bustling office 4 years ago, and they kind of use these as part of it, for especially their Romney campaign was sort of a launching pad to send people out to other states, his swing states, where they can do the campaigning there.
Right.
I think you'll see less of that from Trump. I think we discussed that last week. He just doesn't have the grassroots support here that Romney did. But so the other thing that the Clinton campaign can do is if they can close that gap, and then Trump has to start spending time and money here, then it saps time and money that would be spent in other states,
right,
other swing states. So that there's maybe a strategic component to it as well.
Drawing resources and also, as you said, trying to maybe affect down ballot races, including Doug Owens, Mia Love. Interesting polling there. Trump doing okay here in Utah, if not fantastic. Matt Canham, you wrote this week that Representative Jason Chaffetz is telling Trump to be more transparent, I guess. This is about his tax returns and his health.
Right. So he was on CNN. Jason Chaffetz, who is our member of Congress, most familiar with cable TV news, was making a run of TV interviews, mostly to criticize Hillary Clinton and questions about her emails to a private server and donors to the foundation and ties to and visits when she was Secretary of State. And at the end of this interview was asked, well, don't you think Donald Trump should release his tax returns? And he said, yes, that Donald Trump should open up his kimono, which is a odd metaphor on dangerous image, and release his tax returns. This is a very common practice in presidential politics, that candidates release this kind of information. Hillary Clinton has released 8 years of her tax returns, including her last year, which gives you a sense of how much they donate to charities, what kind of investments they have, and if there's any conflicts with those investments, how they manage their money. Things that you might want to know about a presidential candidate.
Right.
And Donald Trump has steadfastly refused to do that. Neither of them have released much about their own health. They're also, the reason that's important is that they are old candidates. Hillary Clinton is 68. Donald Trump is 70. They will be among the oldest presidents we have. I think Donald Trump would be the oldest president.
Elected.
And because of that, their health is important. And both of them have provided pretty scant information on that front.
A couple of doctor's letters you pointed out.
Yeah, and very brief doctor's letters.
You know, you mentioned Trump being adamantly opposed to releasing his tax returns or saying that he won't do it. What is his stated reason for that?
His stated reason is that he's under audit and he does not want to release that until the audit is done. Lots of people have said that that's not a satisfactory reason, including Warren Buffett, the famed investor from Omaha, who said that he's also under audit and would have no problem releasing his, you know,
right,
tax returns, and would do so jointly with Donald Trump at any moment he wants to. So there's lots of people who say that's not a justifiable reason to withhold that information. But it's clear that from his campaign staffers' comments, that's not going to happen before Election Day.
Mm. And Chaffetz is added now to the list of people calling for that.
And I just to jump onto that point, 65% of Utahns in that poll that we were talking about earlier said that they want that Donald Trump should release his tax returns. So about two-thirds of all of the voters think he should.
And Mitt Romney has hit him on the same thing as well.
And will it affect, I mean, this is just to close this out. Will this affect him if he doesn't? I mean, before the election, is he going to have to do it, or is he just going to not?
He's not going to have to do it. And I think that there is a question. This brings up questions of transparency among our candidates. And clearly, we have transparency questions with both candidates. But it's a big one when you don't give up your tax returns.
Okay. Well, wait and see. Robert Gerke, before we go to a break, just when you thought this story was old news, earlier this week, West Jordan said that it was halting its attempts to court Facebook, which is looking for a location to build a new data center. But apparently, West Jordan was only kidding. What's going on with what's the story?
It's a bizarre kind of twist to the story because for a number of weeks we've been reporting on the build up to this, and it was kind of reached its peak this week when the state school board was supposed to vote. The way it works is there are 8 taxing entities in this area that they need 6 votes from, and already the 2 county votes, both mayors and the councils, were going to vote against it. So it really came down to the state school board vote because all of the others were on board. State school board meets and they say, well, we'll approve it under these conditions. And one of the conditions is that there's a $100 million cap on the first phase of the project in terms of the tax break they can get.
Right.
So they approve it with those conditions, and within an hour or two of them approving that, the city puts out this statement saying, well, we've terminated the agreement. Congratulations, New Mexico. You win. We tried everything we could. Facebook, from what I've been told, kind of responded to that by saying, what? West Jordan didn't talk to Facebook before they put this out. So there were some frantic calls that night and the next morning and some communications. And lo and behold, West Jordan puts out a subsequent statement saying, just kidding, this deal is not dead. We've negotiated throughout the night and we're going to negotiate in the coming days to see if we can come to terms on an agreement. It's too good of a deal to pass up, and we have to pursue it.
And just to be clear, I guess I'm assuming that this means that the tax incentives that are being offered aren't the only thing that a company like Facebook might be considering.
Exactly. I mean, and that was we had a story on that today. I mean, if you look at the deal New Mexico's offering, it's much more generous than what Utah's offering at this point. So they're looking at other things. They're looking at workforce. They're looking at location. They're looking at access to the infrastructure that they need. The energy, the fiber lines, the water, and so these are all things that they have to take into consideration as well. And that's why despite the fact that Utah's incentive, while incredibly generous, is that Utah's still in the game because otherwise, if they were just looking at the dollars and cents, they'd be in New Mexico already by months ago.
Right. So West Jordan's not backing down. They're reevaluating this, renegotiating. Incentives that they're offering are conceivably this $100 million. Well, there's a cap of $100 million on the tax.
Well, there's some discussion because Mayor McAdams, who has been fighting this because he says it's too generous, says it's not a real cap because the $100 million is just on phase one of the project. It's $240 for the life of the project, 6 phases. It was what the total incentive was, $240 million for 6 phases. And so they put this $100 million cap on phase one, and you kind of can do the math and say, well, that may not actually be a real cap at all. And so that's what the mayor says. He says it's still too generous. He's is still opposing it at this point, hoping something can be worked out. But he says it's still too generous. And we're talking about, and his point is that we're talking about 130 jobs, maybe up to 300 tops. But for $240 million, you're paying a lot to get those jobs here.
Right. What about water? There's a lot of water involved in this potential project.
Yeah, and the water's a little unclear, but we do know it appears that the city would be obligated to reserve about 5.3 million gallons of water. And that's a lot of water for a state that is a desert and a state that's growing, and water is a constrictive factor on growth. And so the city manager in West Jordan has said that the company has said that they would use less than 1 million gallons per phase, but you can also see how that adds up fairly quickly. The water is a concern. The energy is a concern, particularly because Facebook is only interested in buying renewable energy. And so there's not all that much renewable energy on the market. We've been told that they would take basically every kilowatt of energy
of renewable energy
off the market at that point. So there are some obstacles to this.
This isn't a need to know question, Robert, but West Jordan codenamed this initiative, I guess, to initially keep it secret. What's the code name
of this?
It's
Project Discus. And actually, it wasn't Wes Jordan that codenamed it. There was a company that came to EDC Utah, and they were trying to keep it secret. And what I was told was that even some of the cities that were interested in this and started negotiating didn't know what the company was until later. So Project Discus, it's very high-tech spy kind of stuff.
When will we know where this data center is going, and when can we get on with our lives?
Well, you just go on your Facebook page, and they'll probably announce it there. We aren't expecting anything this week. I think by next week we should have a better idea of which direction these are going, how the negotiations are going. And there's a possibility, and this is something that's been discussed by people, that the data needs, the data storage needs at Facebook have are so extreme, so extraordinary, that they could build in both places, right. You know, rather than have to, because once they get the one built, they're going to have to turn around and find another location. They could choose them both because they've scoped them out, they've got the incentives in place, and two right. willing suitors.
It makes you wonder whether those incentives are being sort of the false competition that is there is being driven up.
I talked to a professor in Iowa, and he said absolutely that's the case. He said, you know, that it's common for these companies when they're trying to locate a place to go out and find somebody else who, even if they aren't serious about it, you know, you kind of try to play them against each other and make them a little jealous and try to get them in a bidding war. And he says that these incentives that Utah is offering and New Mexico is offering to Facebook are as much as Iowa offered to 8 data centers that have located there in the last 6 years. And so it's pretty extraordinary. He actually said, "What is wrong with you people?" he was not pleased about this. But yeah, I mean, you get into a bidding war, and they call it a race to the bottom to see who's willing to give up the most. And it's sort of a perverse incentive. Mayor McAdams says it's a perverse incentive for cities to like give up the ghost or give up everything they've got, just to get these jobs.
Well, speaking of tech giants, Tony Semmered. Meanwhile, there's some news from Google. A couple of years back, we learned that Salt Lake City has been anointed as a Google Fiber City. This is fiber optic internet and television service, and this week it went into sort of limited release here in Salt Lake City.
That's right. If you are a lucky, or you're interested, and you're a lucky resident from living in a rectangle downtown from about 100 south to 800 south and 400 west to 1300 east, you're in the zone for Google's initial launch. Thousands of residences and businesses and public facilities in that space. You can get their vaunted service is the gigabit service, of course, and that's 100 megs a second throwing up and down, a symmetrical connection. They are offering a host of TV and phone options along this with a very glitzy launch, I might add. They've opened a new fiber space at Trolley Square. Mm-hmm. About 200 people down there watching the lights go on, as it were.
Is this the fastest internet that is around in town in Salt Lake City right now?
It's commercially at the high end. One of the interesting things about all of this is the other carriers, and there are many. Since Google announced about 2.5 years ago, have really flooded the market with, you know, multi-year incentives and trying to, you know, the CenturyLinks and the Comcast Xfinities of the world have gotten a lot of customers kind of sewn up. Mm-hmm. Google's being, you know, very open about that. They've got a somewhat transparent fee structure. They want to kind of earn your patronage.
Sure.
An interesting component of all of this, of course, is Google's digital divide initiative, and they're not only setting the goal of getting these high speed connections to everyone in the city, but they want to boost access that lower income residents have, especially on the west side. But big initiatives with a lot of sort of community groups to boost digital literacy. They've got programs in the libraries, in the schools, and so in addition to economic development potential, there's this incentive on the city side because we're going to get a lot of offline residents online.
Well, there was some city participation, city investment in this, I guess, or initially allowing them to come in and use infrastructure that the city has. Are there any concerns about monopoly of Google Fiber in Salt Lake City?
Well, again, they're a wholesaler or they're a retailer in a competitive environment. The advantages you're talking about aren't insignificant. The city negotiated a kind of an expedited right-of-way processing system before Google would come in, which gives Google a little bit of an advantage in terms of placing cable along streets and on poles compared to some of the other carriers. You know, that we're one of 25 cities where this has happened. There's maybe about six or seven where it's been, you know, Kansas City, Austin, places like that, where it's been in place for a long time. And it has had a significant impact on other businesses. Carriers. I suppose the city would prefer to look at it as a special relationship than a monopoly.
Sure. Where is it headed next? Right now it's in this specific chunk of Salt Lake City. Do we know which neighborhoods will get it next?
Yeah, the build-out's an interesting technical challenge. They've apparently ringed the city with heavy fiber and are kind of drawing connections into various areas. They're not releasing the timetable or where. But the scuttlebutt is, you know, due to some of these digital divide initiatives, that they're focused on the west side next.
Okay. You know, we were talking about the Facebook data center conceivably going to West Jordan. We frequently talk about plans to court tech companies in Draper to replace the prison there. How is Salt Lake City doing in terms of its tech business sort of outreach?
Well, this is against a backdrop of a pretty significant kind of urban renewal movement across the country. There are a lot of companies that are relocating nationally and in Salt Lake from the suburbs into downtown for a variety of reasons, you know, access to transportation and amenities and stuff like that. And so, you know, this is a nice trump card to have if you're interested in especially drawing some of the tech firms into downtown and, you know, advocates for downtown and the city's kind of new economic development initiatives. They know that full well.
Okay. The state has really been hitting this Silicon Slopes initiative hard and trying to get Adobe and eBay. And Facebook is part of that. And there's talk that there's two other large tech companies, presumably Google and Apple, that are looking at locating data centers here as well. The state is really trying to court these because they see this as sort of reinventing an economy that in the past had been dependent largely on natural resources and things like that.
Right.
You get these high-tech companies, the good paying jobs, and it also adds some cachet and prestige to the state and its economic development.
That's Robert Gerke. We're going to have to take another quick break. When we return on Behind the Headlines, the renovation of a dam in American Fork Canyon results in the release of toxic muck. Excuse me. You're listening to Behind the Headline on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
I listen to Bullseye so that I can pretend that I actually know what's going on in the culture and find bands and books and movies and music I love.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Sarah Paulson will tell me about her Emmy-nominated role as Marsha Clark in The People vs. O.J. Simpson. And legendary musician Shuggy Otis will talk about the making of his album Inspiration Information on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Join us Saturday afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Cache Valley ENT and the Allergy Clinic, with providers Dr. Wood, Benyon, and Blotter, with PA Lindsay Humes. Practicing ear, nose, and throat medicine, allergy services, and facial plastic and reconstructive surgery. 753-7880.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm KCPW producer Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Rachel Piper, Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, and Tony Semerad. Join us by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Rachel Piper, the American Fork River has seen better days. Rehabilitation on the dam at the Tibble Fork Reservoir didn't go as expected, and the result wasn't pretty. What happened?
So they've been restoring this dam since midsummer. The reservoir has been closed. It's sort of unclear exactly what went wrong, but it's seeming to show that they didn't really follow the practices that they'd set up when they were planning this project. When they released the water from the dam last week, it carved a 12-foot sort of
Channel,
yes, through the bottom of this reservoir, which was filled with some pretty old sediments, a lot of mud, basically, was shoved down the river, and people described it as looking like coffee, pudding-like consistency. Mm-hmm. And this is a really popular area for anglers and fishermen, and, you know, people were there days before catching, you know, bunch of trout, you know, beautiful clear water. They come back on Monday, and it's the consistency of coffee. There's dead fish all over the shore and everything.
Wow.
So pretty intense.
And that's the kind of damage that was done, was obviously damage to wildlife, to fish. How about, I know that the Utah Division of Water Quality is analyzing water samples, but this river feeds secondary water systems. It feeds agricultural systems. Mm-hmm. What is the advice to people who are using this water?
Right now, there has not been any official advice. They got the test results back yesterday, and we're still analyzing them. But going from the environmental assessment when this project was sort of being approved, they sort of warned against these sediments and said, you know, there's elevated levels of arsenic, among other things, in this sediment that's now in the water.
And this is contamination from, I mean, we presume from historic mining, from gold and silver mining that has piled up as these sediments at the base of this dam.
Yeah.
How is it being addressed? What's being done to fix it?
Well, there's a whole lot of agencies up in the canyon this week. You know, Division of Water Quality, the DEQ, people from the Trout Unlimited, sort of an advocacy group.
Right,
right now, they're working to sort of divert the water around the reservoir so that it no longer is going through the reservoir. They can't just shut off the water, because then that would cause even worse problems for the creek. You know, you'd really see a lot of dead wildlife then.
Right.
So they're building a pipe to sort of route it around this big mud patch.
Could this problem have been avoided? I know that you mentioned Trout Unlimited. The president of Trout Unlimited says that the rate of the release of water into the canyon was too high, too much volume, too fast.
That's what they're saying must have happened. That, you know, they were supposed to let it go down at a rate of 40 cubic feet per second. It's hard to say, but it probably was much faster than that if it carved such a gorge. You know, in the plan, it says that everyone working on the project should follow best practices. What those best practices are aren't really spelled out. So it's, a lot of people are saying clearly they weren't
right.
They weren't followed if this happened. So
determining what those best practices are. The legacy of historic mining, it's a troubling story and one that I guess we'll keep an eye on.
Yeah.
Also on the environment beat this week, protesters gathered at the headquarters of Rocky Mountain Power to deliver a message. What was the message that they delivered, Rachel?
Well, Rocky Mountain Power has sort of a window to sue the EPA right now, the Environmental Protection Agency. And it would be over installing pollution controls on two of its coal-powered plants in Emery County. The reason that the EPA told them to install these is that, you know, our haze in sort of central Utah is obscuring the national parks. You know, pollution means that people go to these national parks and then, like, they stand on a cliff and it's like, oh, I can't see, you know, I can't see the other cliff on the other side of this beautiful park because it's, the air is murky. Hmm. Rocky Mountain Power says that the pollution controls that they've been instructed to install would really just cost a lot of money and not do anything to help the air. So they are planning to sue. Right now they're saying that they're going to do it.
And I know that the state is kind of appealing. The EPA had decided to forego or to override the state's own regional haze plan, and now the EPA had done that, and now the state is trying to appeal that decision by the EPA.
Yes, okay. Yes.
And this is affecting visibility in national parks, canyonlands in particular. If the EPA doesn't change its mind, Rocky Mountain Power, as you said, is going to sue. They've committed to suing. Is that,
yes,
is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so these protesters deliver their message. Any word from Rocky Mountain Power after that?
Just that we're still planning to go forward with this.
And then otherwise, you know, let's say that the lawsuit fails. How long does the state have to comply with these new standards for haze? Do we know?
5 years.
5 years.
5 years.
Okay. Another wait and see moment. Wait and haze, maybe, actually.
Yeah.
You can find the article at sltrib.com. We've reached that point in the show where we've got to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, our final segment. And this is a chance for you guys to tell us a story that maybe didn't get enough coverage in the news or is a sleeper story. Matt Canham, what's your pick for an underplayed story of the week?
Federal, state, and faith groups have launched a new initiative to help people who are in prison transition out to jobs and be successful citizens. This is part of a effort throughout the country to reduce recidivism, and I think that this is an interesting effort to keep an eye on to see if they can actually move the needle. That's something that we'll be watching going forward.
Okay. Matt Canham looking at recidivism, attempts to try and stop that. How about yourself, Tony Semerad?
Well, mine's off the beaten track. I'm fascinated by this discovery of a habitable planet, or potentially habitable planet, one solar system away, Proxima Centauri. Things about the size of Earth in the Goldilocks zone. And, you know, watching the election, I'm kind of cultivating a plan B here. So,
wouldn't it take you multiple generations of lifetimes to get
there? 4 light years. Come on, that's nothing.
How about yourself, Robert Gerke, an underplayed story of the week?
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about the poll that we already discussed a little bit. There were two additional findings that I thought were pretty interesting. One is that 64% of Utahns support legalizing medical marijuana. But my favorite is, considering football season's around the corner, is that Utahns are Ute fans. The 32% of those surveyed are University of Utah sports fans, 26% BYU. So once again, Utah beats BYU.
You have to wonder whether that's not just who they were asking the questions of. It's supposed to be random, but maybe they got that random sampling of all.
Maybe there's a correlation between the legalized marijuana and the Ute fans.
I think so. Write the story. Rachel Piper, what is your pick for an underplayed story of the week this week?
Utah State University has been coming under fire for the way that they handled or didn't handle 4 allegations of sexual assault against one former football player of theirs last year. They released their findings this week, or a summary of the findings of an internal investigation. There's some interesting stuff in there. They say they have a whole boatload of recommendations that they're going to change going forward, including talking to law enforcement, who knew about these 4 women and apparently didn't communicate with the school. We don't know if they did or not because we haven't seen any of those records. One interesting thing, you know, they say that there's no evidence of cover-up of wrongdoing.
Okay.
The summary does not say that there was not any wrongdoing.
Okay, and they do say that they investigated it at the time after the allegations were made.
They don't say that either.
They don't, okay. An interesting one. I'm going to have to forego my underplayed story of the week just due to time constraints. That's it. Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, Tony Semerad, and Rachel Piper, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
We'll wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby talks about people expressing concern for his job. Paul Huntsman is the owner of the Salt Lake Tribune. It's a deal that was finalized, I think, in May of this year, if I'm remembering that right. You write in a column that ever since Huntsman took over, people have been asking you about the stability of your job, and they became even more concerned recently when Huntsman made a big change at the paper, replacing longtime editor Terry Orme with Jennifer Napier Pierce, a former reporter at the Tribune and former news director here at KCPW. How often do you get asked about what the future holds for you, your job, and for the Tribune?
Right after Paul Huntsman bought the newspaper, it was, I would say, shocking to a lot of people because a newspaper, the Salt Lake Tribune, which was built on the platform of being a voice counter to the church in the early days of Utah, a platform to be able to say things to the community that the Deseret News would not allow, had been owned by non-Mormons or ex-Mormons forever.
Right.
And suddenly we find ourselves in the position where a Mormon, an active Mormon, Paul Huntsman, owns the Salt Lake Tribune. And it scared everybody that didn't know Paul. I know Paul's family well enough to know that they don't get pushed around, including by the church. And so it didn't really bother me. I'd heard that, you know, Paul's a fairly liberal Mormon, and he's interested in having this alternate voice in the community.
Preserving that voice, essentially.
Right.
Well, we should say that for a long time, you know, we talked about the non-Mormon ownership, but of course there was a big chunk of time in the recent past where the Tribune was owned by a hedge fund from a distance.
And that was the worst of all. I mean, it's like being owned by Satan, you know. Ex-Mormon, non-Mormon, that's one thing, you know, where you're speaking to the needs that you have in a predominant culture. But being owned by Satan, that was bad.
Well, I'd like to ask you about the most recent change that Paul Huntsman made, which is some thoughts on Terry Orme being replaced by Jennifer Napier Pierce. Maybe just your thoughts on Terry, on Jennifer, and what that change might mean for the paper.
Terry Orme was my boss for a lot of years, the managing editor of the Tribune, particularly during the really dark times when we were owned by Satan. And you're not going to get me to call him anything other than that, unless I can resort to profanity.
Pay the FCC fines, maybe we'll like it.
So Terry took us through the dark woods of that time. He was there through the mass layoffs when the Satan cut our budget. And it was really, really hard on him. It took a lot out of him to have to tell his friends that, you know, you don't have a job here anymore. And so I understood when he elected not to stay because Paul wanted to bring in new blood. I also agree with Paul that we needed that new blood. We need to be thinking more and more about the generations that are coming up and how they want their news and what they expect out of us. Journalism is changing. There's always going to be a market for the truth. There's always going to be a market for people who can reliably deliver it. But the interests are changing. You know, from the generations, the boomers are no longer holding the sway that they once did. And millennials have a different idea about what they want when it comes to news.
But still, I mean, hopefully they would want those watchdogs around carrying out the journal.
They're still going to expect that out of a newspaper, whether it's digital or old school.
Right.
But, I mean, you can't get reliable news but just by listening to blogs. You have to have people that hold themselves to a certain standard to deliver the details of what's going on.
Well, on a lighter note, I know that now that you have Jen as an editor, she's entering on the 1st of September, Jennifer Napier Pierce as your the new editor at the Tribune, the second female editor of the Tribune before you had Nancy Conway.
Yeah, and easily the meanest.
That's what I wanted to get to. You said that Jen can be tough on you if she needs to be, and you know this because she once kicked you.
Yeah, you were here. You saw it.
Well, I just
I was asleep on the floor here in the newsroom and waiting for her to show up so we could do some interviews together. And apparently I passed out or fell asleep. I don't remember which it was, but she came in, saw me there, took pictures of me for evidence.
I've got one.
And then proceeded to kick me awake. She says it was a nudge. I say she full-on kicked me.
Well, okay, so she can be tough on you when she needs to be, and if you need to be kept in line, that's what she's going to resort to, maybe.
Well, yeah, right, and I really look forward to working with her as a managing editor because, I mean, you've read my stuff. You know I need to be managed.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all of his opinions at the Kirby Archives at sltrib.com. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. You can find KCPW on Facebook at KCPW-FM or on Twitter. We are at KCPW. Coming up next here on our station, KCPW presents an hour of curated documentary on Utah Public Radio. It's UPR Presents. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us this morning, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members, and support for science reporting on Utah Public Radio comes from the Utah State University Ecology Center, providing training opportunities for today's science communicators one story at a time.
In the 1970s and 80s, a handful of globe-trotting bands kick-started the international following for music from Celtic roots. Hear vintage sounds from these trailblazers this week on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Join us tonight at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan, also heard at upr.org.